Phoenix. Swan here. I want you to answer a question for me.
Yes?
What would you give me to sing?
Anything you wanted.
Anything? Would you give me your voice?
Try me.
Hello and welcome back to The Letterboxd Show, our podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Gemma, Slim is here too, and we are once again excited to dive into somebody's four favourite films. That somebody this week is a Letterboxd member we've long wanted on the show, ever since or possibly even before the dawn of the Bong Hive. And the stars have finally aligned to bring one of the best writers on culture in existence, no pressure, that's a quote from me, to the Letterboxd Show.
Karen Hahn is our guest this week. She is a film, television, and game writer and a cultural critic whose writing has appeared in some small indie mags like Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, Slate New York, and The New York Times, NBD.
Never heard of them.
Bong Hive, Rise Up. Karen is also the author of Bong Joon-ho, Dissident Cinema. That book is out in November from Abrams Books and Little White Lies. And you can pre-order that right now or as soon as you've done listening to this episode. More on that soon, but first, Karen joins us to talk about her four Letterboxd faves, Phantom of the Paradise,
yes,
Take Shelter, Ping Pong, and of course, a Bong Joon-ho film, The Host. Karen, welcome to The Letterboxd Show.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you so much for gassing me up so much. I really appreciate it. And it's also so kind of you to say that you've wanted me on the show for a long time, because I feel like I have also been a huge admirer of what you guys do for such a long time. So it's like imagining that we're on other sides of a party, sort of just like looking at each other for a few years before finally uniting here on this podcast.
Slowly moving towards the kitchen where we will stay for the rest of the night.
Exactly.
Charcuterie. It's charcuterie time in that kitchen. We've all reached our hand into the board at the same time and we just lock eyes.
Like, oh, are you also getting seltzer? Oh, me too. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So Karen, I'm going to be honest with the three of you right now. So this is the safest space on the internet, this podcast and this podcast
it's
alone.
It's true. No judgment. It's a no judgment zone from the outset.
Yes. Having you on is perfect because I still feel like a relative Bong noob. Mm-hmm. I've only seen Parasite. I recently watched Memories of Murder. And now finally I can reveal for this episode, I watched The Host. So can you help me on this journey? Will you help our listeners this episode spread the love?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. As much as I can. Although I think you have, I mean, he's made seven movies and you've now seen three of them, which I would say you're not a beginner anymore.
Am I an expert now?
I'm just, okay, so since this is a safe space, you're more of an expert than me officially now, Slim.
What? Oh my word. So you've never seen Memories of Murder, Gemma?
No, I have
true?
Parasite and The Host in the pocket, mm-hmm, and that is it.
Oh my word, okay.
And pretty much every interview and every awards acceptance speech that Director Bong ever did during that incredible awards season as well, like... obsessed. But yeah, no, I've got a lot of films to go. So where would you go? I mean, we've got to talk about The Host, but where would you go next after like the big three?
Yeah, I think the good thing is sort of as you're sort of, I think, implying by calling them the big three, it's really a good place to start with Parasite or The Host. Like, because I think they're the most immediately approachable. Like, one of the things I really love about his films is that he does all this really kind of extreme genre work at the same time that he's telling these really human stories. And that's all, I think, pretty easy to get for any viewer. But then there's like so much more stuff that he's doing with like the socio-political context of like the story that he's telling, especially with The Host and Memories of Murder, that won't necessarily come across if you're not familiar with certain parts of Korean history. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, Gemma, for you, I do think Memories of Murder is a good next step. It's definitely, I think, among the most famous or popular of his movies, especially because it gets compared all the time to David Fincher's Zodiac. The funny thing is, like, this precedes Zodiac, but I think Bong in an interview was like, yeah, it's so funny because I almost feel like they are like inspired by each other, even though like Zodiac wasn't out when he made Memories of Murder.
I feel like I've got cinema disease and you are the doctor prescribing, handing out prescriptions.
You guys are too nice to me, but I love it. But don't stop.
This is exciting. What else do we need, doctor?
So I think a good next step is probably either of his co-productions, which would be Snowpiercer or Okja.
Oh, wait, I've seen Okja. What am I talking about?
Oh, yay, great.
Okja. I love Okja. What am I talking about? Oh,
this is a sham. This whole thing is a sham from Gemma.
Restart
she
the show.
She tricked us. This is a scheme. We just fell for it.
The mystery's unraveling.
I am now as much of an expert as you, Slim. We're equal. We're equal. So I'm going to say Okja for Slim next.
Okay. Mm-hmm, all right. Mm-hmm. That's
I totally
a deal.
Agree.
And I think
that's
you should watch it with your son.
Okay. Wow.
Oh.
Okay. All right. That's very high praise.
10, 11, Karen, that's the right age for...
The ending is, there's some bloody bits in it. So I would say, like, depending on his tolerance for gore, maybe be a little
loves
careful.
Gore.
But, oh, okay. Well, in that case.
He's a gore fanatic. We just watched, we watched Prey. We've rewatched the previous Predators. Maybe not the beginning of Predator 2. I think I skipped the beginning of Predator 2. But one of the reviews I wanted to spotlight of yours, after I saw Nope, I thought that I was like, oh, I should have taken my son, James. I think he might have enjoyed it because it had like kind of Amblin-ish vibes for like a horror movie in my thought. So one of the reviews that just cracked me up of yours, I just read from Nope, Michael Wincott, Step on Me.
As soon as you said, I'm going to read one of your Letterboxd reviews, I was like, oh no. Because I feel like they're all like this.
Could be any
like,
of
none
them.
Of them are very incisive.
One of my favorite pastimes is like just out loud reading a Letterboxd review because you never think you're going to hear a Letterboxd review said out loud. And when you do, it just hits differently.
It's like hearing your like shit posts read out loud where you're like, oh no. Like this was never meant to exist in this medium.
That's really interesting that you bring up Note because I feel like Jordan Peele and director Bong exist on a plane that is totally different to a plane that most other film directors exist on, and that all the people trying to unravel Nope, and it's so much fun trying to unravel Nope, just sort of need to remember how it felt to unravel Parasite and how it felt to unravel The Host. Like there's a lot there and we're not going to get it all done in a week, you know, in the first week of opening.
It also honestly... Their style of filmmaking reminds me of like the David Lynch interview where they asked him to expound on something that he said and he was just like, no. Like, can you explain what you mean by that? And he's like, no. Where, I don't know, that was something that I found really interesting about the reactions to Nope, where it's like so many people were trying to like explain what's happened because so much of the media landscape right now is like X explained, which is not in itself a bad thing, but can sometimes detract from like the sense of mystery or from something it doesn't necessarily need to be explained, which I think both Jordan Peele and Bong Joon-ho do, where it's like not everything has to have an answer. Like you can live in the mystery.
Live in the mystery. Never leave.
I'm living in the mystery of whether you have ever played a guitar with your tongue like Beef. And Phantom of the Paradise.
I haven't tried it, but now like I could. Like we have a guitar, so I could just go right now and try to do it.
Live,
I feel like it wouldn't go
live
well,
on
though.
The Letterboxd show.
I was not myself last night. Couldn't set things right with apologies or flowers. Out of place is a crying clown who could only frown, and the play went on for hours.
Which brings us to, and this is the second time we've had it on the show, and it won't be the last, so I finally purchased the film instead of just renting it again.
Ooh.
And nice. You are the reason for that, so thank you. I can turn to Brian De Palma's 1974 rock opera, Phantom of the Paradise, anytime I like now. This has an entirely accurate 4.0 out of 5-star average on Letterboxd.
Who is docking the star?
I know,
who
this
are
is true.
They?
This is true.
I just want to talk.
No, you're right. You're right. It should be 5. But, you know, the 4 means that there are plenty of us 5s out there, I think, Karen.
That's true.
So, rock opera hybrid of sort of something between Phantom of the Opera and Faust. we find fledgling singer-songwriter Winslow Leach, who is played by Brian De Palma Muse, William Finley. He finds himself double-crossed by nefarious music producer Swan, who is played by legendary composer, the legendary Paul Williams, who wrote Rainbow Connection, just for any Muppets fans out there. Anyway, Swan.
Muppet Hive, rise up.
Muppet.
I mean, it's a crucial part of the Paul Williams appeal.
It really, really is. You cannot watch Phantom of the Paradise without thinking of that interview where Kermit just sends him up into the air. He just sends him out. It's great. Anyway, so Swan steals Winslow Leach's music and his girl, Phoenix, played by Letterboxd show fave, our main squeeze, Jessica Harper, for the grand opening of his rock palace, The Paradise. Many other things happen. There's a casting couch. There's a lot of weird group sex with Swan. He has an amazing head of hair. I think I'll just end the synopsis right here and let's get into it, shall we? Why, Karen Hahn, why is Phantom of the Paradise first in your row of four faves on Letterboxd?
Well, there is one, this is the least important reason, which we will not spend that much time on, I'm sure, which is I really wanted to have that picture come up behind my avatar. Like, this is an aesthetic choice where it's like, I signed up for the patron level and I was like, what picture do I want to have on my page? It's probably Phantom of the Paradise because it's so distinct. And I honestly think not just in terms of iconography, but this movie itself is so distinct. Like, there's no other movie that I would point to and say, like, oh, it's like that. Like, I think the easiest point of comparison for people is probably, like, Rocky Horror or something like that. But the stories are so different. The scope of what they're trying to, the two movies are trying to accomplish is also so different. And this movie's so weird. Like, I don't think there's any way you could pitch this to somebody and they'd be like, yeah, we will spend a lot of money to get that made, which makes it all the more exciting for me that it did get made. Where, like, nobody in this is, like, super famous. It's a rock opera, so people are singing songs all the time. There's this weird band that keeps changing into every, like, a parody of every other popular band. Like, Paul Williams is tiny. Like, there's so much about this movie that shouldn't work, and yet I think it all really does.
He is so tiny. That's the whole point of the Kermit interview, by the way, is they're just talking about how short Paul Williams is. Sorry. I have to say that when you say, how did this get funded? I just watched Xanadu this week at the Picture Theatre because of our dear Olivia Newton-John. And I love these 70s films about rock palaces. Like, bring this genre back.
Yeah, absolutely. If disco's coming back, then this genre should also come back.
West Side Story came out and two people wanted to go see it in theaters. So I think it's over. The musical revival is finished. We covered this, let's see, maybe it was like last year, the year before, and that was the first time that I had watched this. And echoing your comments of like, how is this movie a thing? I just went in completely blind. And then I think I just like didn't even know De Palma was involved until his name showed up at the end of the movie. And I was like, excuse me, he directed this?
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that jumped out at me in that viewing. I remember, Gemma, you having like a big crush on Paul Williams. Is that true? Was that a thing that we also discussed?
I mean, he is like really exuding like energy. Sexual energy.
Yeah, sexual. This is the thing. It's like the person, the last possible person you would ever have a crush on. And you find yourself Googling everything about them and sort of trying to work out, is Paul Williams still alive? Will he be at the Toronto Film Festival? Can I possibly get an interview with him? Like, and will he have that head of hair? The answer is he will not. The hair is long gone, but my God, he just... like, he's so wrong in this film. He has a big-ass casting couch. There's a lot wrong, but what's the line that one of the women says on the round bed? If you can sing standing up, you can sing lying down.
Yeah.
There's just so much wrong with this, with him. And yet, am I not the only one? I'm not the only one, am I?
You're not the only one. You can't be. I mean, I also feel like broadly, it's like the appeal... in this character, at least, like, of the devil, where you're like, ooh, like, I know he's nasty, but I like
You had mentioned Rocky Horror, and there's a review from Cobra Rocky. It's like Rocky Horror, but without the annoying theater kid audience and with more going for it than just camp. And did Rocky Horror just like suck the wind out of the sails of this movie? I think it had come out like maybe, what is it, a year after this movie? And I feel like every theater nerd, like everyone you know, most people, you know, like, oh, Rocky Horror, Rocky Horror, Rocky Horror. And I was curious, why did that not happen in a mainstream way? Not that like Rocky Horror love is super mainstream, but it just feels like that relationship isn't quite there with as many people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like there is a huge cult following for this movie, but it definitely doesn't have the name recognition of Rocky Horror. And I sort of wonder if that has something to do with the fact that even though Rocky Horror is pushing boundaries, this story is much less easily palatable, I think, like because it is inherently kind of cynical in the end. It's not really about having a good time, even though I have a great time watching this movie, where it's so much about how like the corporatization of art can sort of corrupt it and destroy it, and how it affects people who even like have others' best interests in mind. Like even though the Phantom is ultimately like trying to make this very pure art, trying to help Phoenix, it's not like he's not culpable either, because he kills a lot of people.
Right.
I mean, he's arrogant from the outset. He knows his music is good and it has to get out there, and he wants his name on it, and he wants the best voice for it if it's not going to be his voice, which, you know, let's not forget at the beginning, he was the only person who he would allow to sing his songs until he could suddenly no longer sing because of a wild accident inside a record pressing plant, for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Like, it's so scary to me.
That accident is, one of the worst in cinema. But you're right, Slim, but I also wonder if it's to do with it not having a time warp type song.
None of the songs are all so good. Are we allowed to cuss on this show?
Absolutely.
Okay, all the songs are so fucking good. But there's definitely not like one like party song or anything. Like so many of them are solo songs and not meant to be like exciting in the same way that I guess Time Warp is, or even like the Meatloaf song, which is so great.
Yeah. And the Meatloaf of it all. I mean, as you say, it's there are slightly bigger names, I guess, in Rocky Horror.
I love the Meatloaf of it all as a phrase. Oh,
it's a great name for a character, and he looks so good. Do you think there is a chance at all that one day on Letterboxd, Phantom of the Paradise, which is currently De Palma's third highest rated film, will one day rank higher than Scarface or Blowout?
Oh, I hope so, but I feel like Scarface has such just a bigger cultural footprint, and I don't know how that would, I don't know how it would win that battle.
I was surprised. I thought Carrie would have maybe been higher. Carrie is very close, 3.9 on Letterboxd now.
Yeah.
Love Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, Brian De Palma's great. He's such a weirdo. I love him. The documentary on him from a few years ago was so good, just because he kept going, holy mackerel. I was like, this is great. He's weird.
Need to bring that back.
I need to bring put that on back. My watch list. That is going straight to watch list.
So, Karen, you mentioned the backdrop was the main reason, and patron members get that if they upgrade. So if anyone also wants to upgrade at 20% off, make their own backdrop, Paradise.
This is like the adult version for me of like customizing my MySpace page, where I'm like, ooh, I want my little Phantom of the Paradise.
You graduated up. You can become a patron, 20% off using the code Paradise or the link in the episode notes. Just like Karen, we're all adults here. You know, we choose our faves by backdrop photos. Why not?
Okay, but to be clear, I love this movie. Yeah. It is one of my favorite movies. There's a giant poster of it up in my house.
Is it the same as the Letterboxd poster? Because that's another thing patrons can get soon. I mean, this has just turned into a sales pitch.
Big time sales episode.
No, it's a different one, unfortunately. But all the posters for it are so good.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, so very soon, Karen Han, you'll be able to select your own favorite.
It was like Karen had just won the Stanley Cup in that moment with the celebration.
There is a review of this film, which I love. It's from Dante from the, I don't know what their Letterboxd name is. It's featuring Dante from the DMC series. That is a wild Letterboxd username. Anyway, nothing cheers me up like watching Paul Williams absolutely decimate an innocent man's life. Which, speaking of potentially decimating an innocent man's life, brings us mm-hmm. to your second film, Jeff Nichols' mm-hmm. Take Shelter. 2011, featuring the, I had to look it up, 6'5" Michael Shannon.
Wow.
And the 5'5" Jessica Chastain.
Love that for me.
Exactly. It has a 3.8 average, but only, you're one of only 307 Letterboxd members who have it in their four faves. So,
wow, really?
This is your chance to stand for Take Shelter, which is this incredible film that, you know, landed at 2011 film festivals and just absolutely shattered audiences across the world. Mm-hmm. Plagued by a series of apocalyptic visions, a young husband and father questions whether to shelter his family from a coming storm or from himself. What a synopsis.
Michael Shannon, step on me.
Yeah, he should.
I know you're listening, Michael. I know for a fact you're listening right now. You're using that patron code 20% off. Where does Take Shelter fall? Where was the first time you saw it? Do you have the memory of the first viewing for this movie?
I actually don't remember when I first saw it, but it had such a strong impact on me. Like, this is the first Jeff Nichols movie that I saw. I saw this before I saw Shotgun Stories, which is, I think, his first feature. And I just think he's brilliant. And I'm so sad that he hasn't had a movie in a while. And I'm just looking, I just keep like Googling, like, what is Jeff Nichols doing? But I think something just got announced for him with Michael Shannon again. So I'm very excited for that. But I think he's just an incredible director. Like, he just knows, we talked earlier about like embracing the mystery. And I think he really, really knows how to do that. Like, he knows how to build a story in a way that isn't too hand-holdy for the audience, but still leaves you room to figure something out. And in this movie in particular, I think I'll backtrack a little bit. I think one of the things that I really like about his movies is the way that he tends to use magical realism in how he tells his stories. Like, more often than not, the stories that he's telling are about like pretty like small town, small people kind of vibes, but the things that happen to them, even if we don't necessarily think that they're that important, obviously feel hugely important to those characters, which I think is sort of what's going on in Take Shelter. And especially as it sort of becomes more and more difficult to tell whether or not this kind of apocalyptic event that this man thinks is going to happen is actually something that he is right about, or is something that he's just too in his head about. It's just, it's so good. It's so good.
Some lists, Anxiety-Inducing Cinema by Jack. They aren't films, they're experiences by Simon, and Essential Depression Core by Obsolete. Some lists that this movie appears on. I think I saw this a few years after release. This must have been like a DVD rental or something for me. Mm-hmm. And this might have been before I had seen Midnight Special, which mm-hmm. I love. Midnight Special is so
incredible
good.
Incredible movie.
And I think at the time I thought this was like, man, what a weird little movie. And then on this recent watch, I was pretty excited because I had like vague memories of certain things happening in this movie. And God, I loved it. I loved it. I loved the scene when they're leaving the bunker, the actual shelter, and he doesn't want to open it up. And they have that mm-hmm. long, like, stressful conversation with Jessica about, you know, we have to get out, we have to leave, and then they do. And I love that. I love the reaction to what is actually happening outside. And then more than that, the ending of the movie. I love the ending of the movie. So I'd love, and maybe if you haven't seen Take Shelter, maybe skip ahead a little bit, but I'd love to hear all of our interpretations of that ending, because during the movie, he's dealing with certain visions. And on one hand, you can see that maybe he's going through kind of like an episode or something in his brain is happening. Maybe it's real, maybe it's not. And then you see what happens at the end with Jessica. How do you interpret the ending of this movie, Karen?
To be honest with you, I feel like I sort of leave it as it is. Like, I don't feel the impulse to, I feel the impulse to like keep thinking about it because the movie affects me so strongly, but I don't feel the need to sort of, I guess, think about an answer, if that makes sense. And this isn't to say that that's like the wrong way to watch a movie or whatever. It's just like, it is richer to me not knowing exactly what the answer is, if that makes sense.
You're off the show. I'm cutting the show.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much.
I had a different, my jury is out on movies that, wait, maybe he wasn't so crazy after all. But on this one, it's same with you, Karen. I kind of was like, I'm fine with the ambiguity, because what I think is unambiguous is the connection between Michael Shannon and Jessica Chastain's characters mm-hmm. in that moment, in that whether or not what is happening to Curtis and Samantha in that moment is real, what is happening mm-hmm. between them is real and strong. Yeah. So they've been through this thing where she's had to spend the entire film coming to terms with the fact that he is having some sort of breakdown, and then mm-hmm. coming to terms with her role as his wife in that breakdown, which is to protect their daughter, but also not abandon him like the rest of the town does. I love the world building mm-hmm. of this film. Like, basically, it's the kind of town where as soon as one usually solid guy has the look of crazy about him, everyone else is like, fuck no, fuck no, fuck no. And they mm-hmm. basically kind of run from this family. And so I think once they've gone through the whole shelter business, and she's been the incredibly strong one who's managed to get him to, you know, unlock the door, then she's fully there with him. Whether or not the thing is happening, it's her turn to trust him. And so mm-hmm. that was it for me. It's more the sort of portrait of how a good relationship, how a long relationship can work. Because they have all this, like, they have all these dealings with the health industry, and that moment when he sees the second therapist who asks him all the same questions that the first one did, and he just gets up and walks out. It's like, I can't, you know, we've all had that, haven't we? This sort of repetition, the dreary repetition of trying to get ourselves heard by medical professionals. I was fascinated by all of that, and so I've landed on, because I kind of get, to be honest, okay, I'm going to speak my truth. I get kind of pissed off with ambiguous sci-fi endings. No, more than pissed off. I'm still not being honest. I get really mad with ambiguous sci-fi endings. I get to these end of these movies and I just go, why did I waste my time? But in this case, I felt like there was a very, very strong story in there about a marriage. And I was good with it.
I think that actually speaks to like what I think makes Jeff Nichols so special as a filmmaker, where like even though these extreme things are happening to his characters, like it's still ultimately about the emotional journeys that they're going on. Like Slim, you mentioned Midnight Special, which is also a movie that I really, really love. And that's what I think makes that movie good. Like there is this very supernatural element of like, oh, like what's going on here? But ultimately it is just about like a dad and his son and his relationship with him. He paints such beautiful pictures. I love Jeff Nichols. Yeah.
I didn't think of it until just now, but I'm comparing my experience with the end of Annihilation to the end of this movie, where like you can have your own different viewing of what transpired. Each viewer might have different thoughts. One of the Letterboxd reviews, and we'll spotlight from Lauren. So much crazy shit going on that Jeff Nichols was able to pull a fast one and make the idea of sleeping in denim seem normal. I couldn't imagine being more uncomfortable than sleeping in denim. Lucy's review, the sexual tension between me and the weather from now on after I've seen this movie. Well said, Lucy.
I just, my main note from this was how much of the time allocated to this film on this show can we spend talking about Michael Shannon? But
and, I mean, so much.
Right? I mean, I have to say, I told another lie about his height. He's actually 6'3", not 6'4". But still.
Oh, God.
But still.
He's a tall guy. He's got a very imposing presence. My boyfriend likes to tell this story. When we were still living in New York, we were coming out of a subway and he just sensed to this presence that to him felt inherently threatening, and like went to look, and he was like, oh, like I have to avoid this. I have to see what this is. And it was just Michael Shannon walking into the subway.
Oh my God. I have completely the opposite New York Michael Shannon story, which was that for a very brief 2-month period, my young child was in a daycare around the corner from our house in Brooklyn. And we would do pickup around about the same time as Michael Shannon would be picking up his daughter. Aww. And we'd all go to the same cafe afterwards, which had a playroom next door, and just kind of sit there on our phones while our kids played. And I spent the whole time going, why are you such a New Zealander? Why can't you just say hello? Why can't you just why can't you just say, hey, are you on Letterboxd?
Are you?
What's your Letterboxd? I couldn't do it.
Yeah, drop the secret Letterboxd account.
Yeah, I couldn't even, yeah.
So you shared a room with Michael Shannon with both of you on your phones looking down.
Basically. Incredible. Such a 2022 story. I was trying to train my child to go and play with his child deliberately. Like, I don't know, like hit her or something so that we'd have to interact and have a conversation.
The fact that you're like still regretting it.
But it's so funny because I'm like, did not sense a threatening presence, or maybe I did and that's why I never spoke to him anyway.
Shall we move on to our next film? 2002, Ping Pong. 3.5 average, and believe it or not, we're going down in fans. 21 fans.
Wow, that's a party.
Only 20 other people have this in their four faves.
Karen, we can get them. We can get their emails for you. You can have a dinner party.
We're still at the dinner party number for this movie. We can all hang out. The charcuterie board is being replenished as we speak.
The brie, the brie is getting melty. It's just perfectly melty on the board right now.
Someone's got to eat it.
Yeah. So is there anything more distinct than the sound of ping pong balls being crushed underfoot is the question I have about your third favorite.
Oh my God.
How did you find this story of, I'm just going to read this awesome synopsis that somebody wrote for the show, me. Pico, who is the kind of annoying friend who only sings the Born part of the Born in the USA chorus with his headphones on, and Smile, his best friend since childhood who bears emotional scars of bullying, navigate the psychologically bumpy roads of competitive high school table tennis.
I found this movie through my dad. I don't know how he heard about it, but he got the DVD for our house and we watched it together, and that's how I came to know it. And I think it was also around that time that he was sort of introducing me to a lot of other Asian cinema as well. Linda, 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 the that movie, and also Water Boys. I think that's what it's called. But there were several movies like sort of like this where it's like about adolescence sort of growing up and navigating like different changing friendships and stuff. And this was one of them. And I just really loved it. Like, I don't think it's going to win Oscars or anything. And obviously it didn't. But at the same time, like, I think the acting is so good. I think the story is told in such a simple and really fun way because they both have really different relationships to the sport of ping pong, which is what kind of drives the central conflict. Like, it's a sort of Mozart Salieri story where Pecco is kind of the Salieri where, like, he really wants to be good at ping pong and works so hard at it in order to be good. Whereas Smile, who doesn't really care about it, doesn't really have to work very hard at it in order to be really good. Another one of the things that happens is like their coach basically like sees the potential in specifically Smile and sort of gets mad at him for not taking advantage of that potential or not feeling passionate about this thing that he's clearly good at. But sometimes that's just life. Like, things that you're good at, you don't really care about, and the other things you do care about.
So this is obviously a first time watch for both of us, Slim. What?
Yeah.
How did it land for you?
I liked it a lot. I was actually pretty surprised by some of the lines that these characters replied with. I think there was one line that was happening in the conversation about like the desire to succeed when I don't really care about ping pong. You know, there's such an integral part of these boys' lives. Some birds can't fly. It reminded me of the quote from Superman the movie when Clark was like complaining about not being able to kind of show how good he can be at sports because of his talents. And there was also another line later in the movie about, you know, the conversation that happens in the bathroom and just kind of being alone with your thoughts. And there was a line was, there's more than diarrhea that drives a man to a toilet. Just like, I watched it alone, but I was like looking around to like just get reactions of nobody else I was watching it with. I was like, what a line.
It's
my
so
God.
Funny, it's like, it's so... Yeah, it's like such a philosophical movie at the end of the day, but also like so silly and kind of cartoonish in that way.
I love that line, that chop wouldn't cut tofu, from Granny. She's like, I love how we never see her playing table tennis and yet she's the world expert at table tennis. Right. So
she's also so cool. I love her.
She's so cool. Oh my God, she's one of the best characters in film. I really love these sorts of stories that in films that show the that bump in the teenage road where you start to wonder what all the practice is for. Because there's a point in our lives where we do the thing because everyone else is doing the thing and we're kind of good at the thing and we've got nothing else to do after school because we're teenagers. And then all the other late teenage things come into play, like girls and whatever. And it's sort of, there's a similar storyline in Girl Picture, which just came out this year with an ice skater who finds love. And then suddenly she's like, why am I doing this? What am I doing this all for? Mm-hmm. At the heart of it is that what happens when two best friends are both really good at the thing?
It's like a surprisingly adult story. Like, because even I love like the part of the movie that is, Gemma, what you're talking about, where it's like figuring out your life when you're at this point between childhood and adulthood, where you're like, does this really matter to me? But then like even the adult characters are sort of dealing with this, where like the coach, we realize, like, used to be sort of in their position where he was a rising star in the ping pong world and then ended up having to give it up for a reason that I won't spoil here. But then like holding on to that and like holding on to old feelings, I guess, is such, and how much you decide to let something take over your life, because that's sort of what the coach is grappling with. And also what one of the other like opposing players that ends up in the bathroom is dealing with, because like he's so intense about ping pong that that's like the only thing that he cares about.
Slim, do you feel like you could be a ping pong champion after watching this film?
No. I have friends that play ping pong. It's like fun. Like I can play ping pong a little bit with like my other friends that are not good. But then when you have like a good ping pong player coming, it's like, all right, fun's over. Let's go find something like else to do.
Playing Super Smash Brothers, where as long as everyone's on the same level, it's fine. But then if someone really good comes in, then you're like, what's the point? Why are we doing this?
I will point out too, you know, this is a live action adaptation of a very popular sports manga. And man, sports manga, so huge in, you know, mainly outside of the US, but this is just kind of an aside, but there's also a big like cooking manga. Like I've read some like cooking manga that would blow any US comic like out of the water. There's just so much in the world of manga outside of the States that would just blow minds.
What do you mean? Do you mean like the Great British Baking Show, but Japanese version in manga? Or do you mean like competitive cooking or just cooking?
The name escapes me. I'm not sure if Karen, have you ever read it, but there's almost kind of like a D&D group that are traversing through, I think, like a high castle. And to proceed, they have to like make a certain dish. Delicious in dungeon. When young adventurers and his company are attacked, the party loses all its money and provisions and a member. They're eager to go back and save her, but there's just one problem. If they set out with no food or coin to speak of, they're sure to starve on the way.
Wow.
So they come up with a brilliant idea. Let's eat the monsters. So they defeat the monsters and then they eat them on their journey.
Slim and Karen starting a manga podcast after this. Is this happening?
Okay, but I do want to note, a side note, the anime is by Masaaki Yuasa, who I think you guys are probably familiar with, who just released Inu-Oh.
Yeah.
Short Walk-On Girl, Lou Over the Wall. He's amazing. So obviously watch the anime also. Watch the live action movie too.
Watch the live action movie too. And specifically for the performances of Yosuke Hobuzuka and Arata Yura, who play Smile and Pico. Yeah. I love their performances. Like, they are so distinct. It sounds like a stupidly basic thing to say, but I feel like today's films of teenagers are just, everyone's very kind of real within bounds. And both of these actors kind of step slightly out of the bounds of what normal, neurotypical, whatever teenage sports kid looks like or does or acts like. And but in a way that feels real, not comical. And I really, really, really enjoyed their performances. I really enjoyed understanding that they're absolutely distinct humans.
Yeah. And it's also the weird movie where like, even though they're supposed to be high school students, but they look like in their late 20s, it like doesn't bother me. Like just because their performances are that good. And I have to say, one of the reasons that I was so excited for Martin Scorsese's Silence is when I found out that Yosuke Kubazuka was going to be in it. I was like, oh, Pecco's in a Scorsese movie.
I love that so much. Yeah, there's a review from Dan P. that points out the the age of the casting. There's a lot working against this adaptation, in my opinion, of the best sports manga of all time. The adult cast playing teens, the extremely Japanese wink at the camera comedy acting, the elevator music soundtrack, but goddamn, it's still such a great story. I liked the soundtrack. I also love Ali's review. Boys born after 1993 can't cook. All they know is play ping pong, Street Fighter 2, be homosexual, eat sour chip and fly.
Oh, and fly. Fly. That's so sweet. I also, okay, I keep saying also on the things that I want to say about this, but this film also, I think, is a pretty good introduction to a lot of other Japanese actors that you'd come across. Like, if you go in further into Japanese cinema, like the coach, the actor of the coach, Naoto Takenaka, is in so many Japanese movies and he's so funny in all of them. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
No. Which ones? I love that.
Shall We Dance, I think, is the big one.
That's a gorgeous film.
And also, the old lady is Yubaba in Spirited Away. Like, this cast, it's all legends. They're all wonderful. Okay, one last ping pong note. I swear this is the last one, for real this time. The actor Naoto Takenaka, who plays the coach, he is actually in one of Bong Joon-ho's short films, which is another reason to love Ping Pong, the movie.
Whoa. And is the perfect segue, without you even knowing it, into a little bit of Bong book talk. So backing right up, Karen Han, at 9:33 p.m. on May the 21st, 2019, you sent the first hashtag Bonghive tweet into the world. You were in a queue at Cannes with Letterboxd's own Alec Kemp and several other film friends, waiting to see if you could get in to see Parasite.
I remember because the day previously, I think, Iana Murray and I had been in the queue for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and not gotten in. And so we were sort of feeling a little bit nervous at this point where I was like, oh, it's possible that we won't get to see this movie. But this was definitely the one that I was more excited for. No shade to Quentin Tarantino, but I love Bong so much. And the fact that he had a new movie at Cannes, like while I was there, was like, mind-blowingly exciting. And I was like, if I see one movie at Cannes this year, it has to be Parasite. Like, this is the thing that I'm most excited for. And I hadn't had like coffee or caffeine or anything, but I remember like in the line, I just kept getting like more, I just kept like vibrating like more and more. I was just like, and then I think I was just like, should I tweet Bong Hive? Is that a thing, Bong Hive? And then I just sent it and then went into the screening pretty much immediately right after that. And then like, I remember when we came out and the vibrating was only like worse because that movie's so breathtaking. And I was just like, sort of like in the fetal position on the street outside of the theater. I don't know for how long, but it was like, it's such a special moment. It's such a special movie. He's amazing. I love him.
That had to have been pre-hype because I remember around this time, it started to get like super nuclear at that point. So you were at the ground floor.
Yeah, because there were no reactions that I had heard prior to going into it because this was like the first time that it was being shown. And I don't know, I think that's sort of like the fun thing about movies. Like, it's not necessarily seeing a movie and being like, oh, this is going to just fucking change the game. But seeing a movie and being like, I love this movie. Like, this movie makes me remember like, oh, this is like what's so exciting about going to go see a movie where you're like, oh, like, this rules. There's so much that's like good about it. And I just want to talk about it with everybody. And like, that's definitely how it felt at that moment. And there was just no way, I think, to predict just how much of an impact that it would have, like, when it opened. Just because, like, again, it still looks almost impossible for me to believe that it won the Best Picture Oscar, even though, like, I watched it happen on TV. Just because, like, it was so unheard of. And there's no, like, foreign film that's really had that much of a footprint, or at least not often enough that it seemed like it people were really going to get on that train. And yet they did. It's all unbelievable. It's so wonderful.
It was so wild. I remember watching that happen, you know, being on Letterboxd Twitter and keeping an eye on all things watching Bong Hive happen, watching the takes come out and then going, how long am I going to have to wait and sit through this buzz? And then within the month, I shit you not, within the month, the Academy Cinema in Auckland, New Zealand had a print of it ahead of the New Zealand International Film Festival. Wow. They were just like, we are getting it out of Cannes. So so we bought tickets for the Letterboxd crew and we went down and we probably saw it, you know, like before most other editorial teams in the world, luckily enough, because we all just happened to be here. And then I headed off to TIFF later that year, September, and had my brief moment with Director Bong on the red carpet, which it was such a great moment for us because we just, you know, we're a little outfit. Yeah, yes, more and more people know about us, but at that point in time, you know, it was still just insiders like you and Slim. And so to be on the red carpet and watch him come past, the rest of the media were Korean media. So he was very much favoring speaking with them. And I was like the one English speaking on the carpet. And he kind of was being walked past me. He wasn't walking past choosing to. He was being walked past me. And I just kind of went, Director Bong, congratulations on your film that is not only the highest rated film of the week, the month, but also the entire year, but also the entire decade on Letterboxd. Oh. And he spun on his heel and came back and said,
I'm so happy with that. So all the cinephiles, film geeks, and so
could you introduce yourself?
Me also the cinephile. So I'm very happy with that news. Thank you.
But actually, I talked to him when they came to New York for the press tour. I also want to say, like, I think it's, we forget now that it was literally like months after the Cannes screening that anyone else got to see it.
Yes.
So that was like months of hype that it should be impossible to live up to. And yet this movie absolutely did. Like, there was no one that I think, that I know at least, who saw this movie after all that hype and was like, it didn't live up to that. Everyone was like, yeah, this movie rules.
I was still very late to the game. I think I gave that 5 stars. I don't have my Letterboxd review in front of me, but I loved it. And that was my first movie of his. Mm-hmm. And it is tough to like have to sit through the hype of movies these days. I feel like it's hard because depending on who you're friends with on Letterboxd, you could hear about a movie and then not hear about it for another 6 months. Like Marcel Duchamp with Shoes On has had such a staggered release for so long. And I like, as soon as I saw it, I kind of almost like worried. I'm like, I love this movie, but most people can't see this for like, I don't know how long. So I was like, what do I actually want to say about this? Because I didn't want to like take part in it, but it's not the movie's fault. Like they make these perfect movies and you want everyone to experience them and learn more about the creators behind them. So I had an amazing time seeing Parasite.
Speaking of learning more about the creators behind them, Bong Joon-ho Dissident Cinema, book coming out in November, written by you, Karen.
Thank you so much for doing my plugs for me.
Oh, dude. With a foreword by David Lowery, no less. That's pretty fancy.
Yeah. So I feel like if you're listening to the Letterboxd show, you're probably familiar with the series of books that Abrams and Little White Lies work on together. Most notably, they've worked a lot with the writer Adam Neiman, the critic Adam Neiman, on his books on Paul Thomas Anderson, David Fincher, the Coen brothers, and recently released a book by Hannah Strong on Sofia Coppola. And my book on Bong Joon-ho is the latest in that series. So it's pretty much a rundown of his work where I have a chapter devoted to each of his movies and then even to his music videos and short films. And then we also have a really wonderful series of interviews with some of his closest collaborators, including Tilda Swinton and Toshik. And I keep telling like my friends where it's like, don't read my writing, just because I'm like so afraid of anyone reading my writing at any time. I'm like, don't read my writing, just read the interviews because they're so good. All these people are so incredibly good at what they do and so thoughtful. And some really funny stories are in there as well. So that's my elevator pitch for my book.
Also, it's a hardcover. Gotta get your hands on these hardcovers. Hardcovers are coming back in a big way.
Yeah.
I'm not a book expert. Maybe they never left. I don't know, but I'm making the statement that they're coming back.
Also, the Little White Lies team is just, they're such brilliant designers. Like the book, I've been looking at the insides of books for, a couple months now, and it looks great. I'm so excited for everyone to see that. I'm so scared for my text to be out there, but so excited for everyone else's work because I've seen it and it's beautiful.
Which brings us to the host, your fourth four favorite. Is that how you say it? Fourth. Oh
yes,
God.
You have a long delay before the S. That's the main. That's the English version. The host, 2006, 3.7 average, 422 fans. This one is, I feel like, almost everyone I know has seen this at some point. I think this is what we talked about at the top of the show. It's in that kind of like top three of his filmography. No, the synopsis. Hold on. Let me see.
I'm going to start from the top. an American thinks it's a good idea to dump gallons of toxic waste in the Han River.
What could go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong is a giant mutated squid-like creature appears and begins attacking the populace along the riverside. Angdu and his father have a small food business right by the river. His daughter Hyun Xiao is snatched up by the creature and everything goes mayhem from there. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
That's pretty good.
I have to say, this is a first time watch for me. I looked at the poster. I knew it was by Bong Joon-ho, but I didn't see anything in the poster that made me want to watch it. And yet, when you look at it, you go, actually, posters are marketing, and what they're marketing is a creature feature, and what this is a creature feature like no other creature feature. So it's fine, it's fair. If you're marketing to that audience and you want them to experience a creature feature like no other, then that's cool. But if you want me to watch it, I don't know, what would I want?
It's sort of funny because I think Bong has sort of spoken to this point, like in talking about this movie, where he's like, or at least I think, like, it's not a monster movie so much as a movie that happens to have a monster in it. Driving impetus, again, as you say, is like when Kang Du's daughter Hyunsa like gets abducted by this monster. But it's not like this monster is super malevolent or anything. Like, it just is a byproduct of human carelessness and just wants to eat to live.
Yeah.
And the main story is less, what are we going to do with the monster, than the family trying to get back their stolen member and also deal with the fact that rampant government incompetence is hindering them from doing anything. And in fact, is like actively harming them.
Yeah, that's the story. And that's the poster I would need to get on.
How do you put that on a poster? Yeah.
Patrons, maybe soon you'll be able to choose your own poster on Letterboxd, by the way. You too, just like Gemma, can choose your own host poster. But this was a first time watch for me as well. This is going to sound like a negative, and I don't mean it that way, but I didn't know that there was like so much monster in this. Like, or not like, I mean, maybe like visually. And it almost felt like the CGI probably has been talked about. Like, it felt almost like sci-fi movie CGI, but it didn't work against it at all for like my viewing. Like, it didn't take me out of it at all. Like, I watched it. I was like, well, the CGI is kind of interesting for this creature. But that's not even the point. Like, the creature, like, almost isn't even, like you said before, it's not the main thing. There are so many great small family moments between the characters. Like, after the daughter is presumed dead, taken, there's that conversation that they have while they're, like, while he's falling asleep together. Like, all the siblings are, like, asleep, and the dad is talking, and he's like, lay off your brother.
And they
tell that story, like, oh my God, what an amazing scene in this movie. Holy cow.
It's the single best scene in a film with so many best scenes. Okay, this might sound like also a negative, and I don't mean it as a negative, but I like this more than Parasite.
Whoa.
I mean, I think it's definitely more, like, quote-unquote, like, fun, to be fair. Like, it definitely is more... I don't know. Yeah. Well, what am I trying to say? But I mean, because I obviously can't pick a favorite of his movies. I think they're all so wonderful. But I will say this is the first of his movies that I did see a long, long time ago.
Can I just say Song Kang-ho, Step on Me?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm going to search Step on Me in like Letterboxd reviews just to see what comes up after this episode.
Who is it? Who is it we want to
it's
be stepped
me,
on?
It's just me and Gemma. It's just me.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's amazing. He is maybe one of my favorite actors. Everything I've seen him in, he's off the charts.
It's funny because he and Bong are actually referred to as the Ho-Ho brothers in Korean media because it's Bong Joon-ho and then Song Kang-ho. So they're called the Ho-Ho brothers, which is quite cute. But anyway.
I think we're drifting into like spoiler territory about, you know, eventually the end of the movie. So if you want to fast forward, by all means. I mean, it gets really tense. Like, there are so many scenes where I was like, they're so close to finding the monster because she makes the phone call and they find out that she's somehow still alive. Like, she was taken by the monster, but there's a few others that are still alive with them. And they have to try to triangulate the phone call records. I mean, the one scene where he's led to the building where they can triangulate the data, and it was all a setup. Oh my God. And the guy goes into that room and then he has that big escape.
Oh my God, that scene. But that's one of the camera reveals I'm talking about. Like, there are so many ways that director Bong uses the camera where other directors would choose a kind of jump scare or a jump cut. And he just moves it, and it's the it's that office building when he's walking, and you see the camera move, and there's the school friend and all of the other people in the office, and then it's the scene in the lab where they're doing the lobotomy, and then he flings the doors open, and you're like, whoa, what? Where are we? That's such a great moment. There's so many moments like that where it's all it's all done. It's massive production design to achieve a absolutely thrilling result.
Yeah. And also, like, so many weirdly funny small moments, like in the scene with the school friend where the friend, like, sells him out as he's, like, running away. The friend still puts up, like, a fist in, like, solidarity. And it's like, you don't get to do this anymore. But it's so funny.
So I was talking about the ending, and I just, that the whole journey, like, you kind of are hoping, you know, the sister with the archery skills. I'm like, oh my God, I hope she, like, just let's just find her. Like, oh my God, let's wake up. Let's find her. I wanted them to find her so badly. And, you know, the ending maybe not goes the way you expect it to, but it does still have that positivity with the boy taken in and they're in the shop. I love the ending. I also just kind of want to run my own snack shop. Like that little like snack shop by the water. I'd be down to do that.
It doesn't seem like the worst life.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that the ending is pretty classic Bong in that respect, where he will never take the simple or easy way out of any scenario. Like, it will always be something that I think he probably feels is like truer or more honest or earnest as an ending, where like this is ultimately what's more likely to happen if something like this happened.
What I love about that too is that he does, you know, some quite classic storytelling stuff where he absolutely signposts at the beginning in very classic ways certain things like that the sister is quite hesitant with the bow and arrow, with her archery, and that and we're like, okay, that might be a problem later on if she's going to go for a kill hit. The father is saying, you know, when an animal kills a child, it is human's responsibility to tear the animal to pieces. And you're like, okay, are we going to see this animal torn to pieces by this specific family? But the ways in which those classic signposts, which in any sort of most other Hollywood movies would play out almost exactly as you imagine, the ways that they play out in a Bong movie are just so inventive and so fun.
Yeah. And honestly, I think like there's that signposting, but even more essential signposting in the first scenes of the film. Like the first three scenes that we see are the American officer telling the Korean worker to dump these chemicals in the river, which, by the way, is based on a real incident.
Yes.
And then we see like this guy, we see these fishermen in the river who come across the baby mutated being like, oh, like, what's this? And then we see this man about to commit suicide on one of the bridges and seeing the shadow go underneath him. All those things are representative of huge themes in the movie, at least as far as I see it. Like the first being the American influence on Korea and like this weird like nationalism and the bureaucratic chain. And then with the fishermen, one of the fishermen like notes as he's scooping up the mutated fish that the cup is from his daughter, which I think like sort of symbolizes the bond between Kang Do and Hyunsa. And then the guy on the bridge, when he sees the shadow, he's like, you guys are all idiots for not being able to see this, which speaks to the fact that the family is all like so vehemently being like, you have to listen to us. You have to listen to what we're saying, while everyone around them just won't listen to them.
I love Holly Amanda's Letterboxd review that Jax Facts dug up for us. Bong Joon-ho said, of course I support America's rights. America's rights to shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Classic meme.
So good. And Oppie, this movie has been around since 2006 and some humans still litter. Shaking my head. Hope you'll get eaten by a giant catfish monster. So true. What do we have to do? How many Bong Joon-ho films about toxic waste and its after effects do we have to have made in order to save ourselves and this planet?
It's funny because there actually is a big statue of the monster on the banks of the Han River, which I understand some people didn't like just because it's so scary looking. They're like, please don't do that. But it is there and you can go take pictures of it.
That is so cool.
I have actually one other thing I want to say about the monster, which is that when they were figuring it out, Bong gave the, like, I think animators a specific picture of a specific character in a movie to base the monster on. Do you guys know?
Yeah, who it was? There's quite a few Letterboxd reviews alluding to this,
it's
which
so
I love.
Good.
I love.
It's so funny. Yeah, so it was Steve Buscemi's character in Fargo. He was like, "Think about this when you're thinking about the creature." Because again, like, it's not like mean. It's just like everything is wrong with its body. It's just annoyed all the time, and like that's the frame of mind that it's in. It's not malicious in any way.
And just the sheer knowledge of that production detail means that you've got review after review on Letterboxd of people saying early on when the Steve Buscemi monster is attacking people in the park, ...
I really wonder if Steve Buscemi knows this. Like, has anyone told him? Has he talked to Bong? I need to know.
Also, just by the way, Steve, I know you're listening. You can get 20% off Patreon upgrade with code PARADISE, by the way, Steve. And usually at the end of the show, before we wrap up, we like to look at your stats, the guest stats. Karen, we got your secret stats right in front of us. It's not secret. You can read them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But there's a section that we like to call out before we wrap up, which is the rated higher than average section.
Oh, no.
So movies you've rated higher than the average on Letterboxd. Some of these very significantly, by the way. One of which maybe is pretty relevant to my interests. And I agree. I'm not sure if I agree it's a 5-star movie, but Triple X with Vin Diesel, 5 stars against a 2.29 average with Letterboxd community. Tell us.
Here's the thing. It's not a good movie, but I had such a good time watching it. And sometimes that is what my rating reflects.
Yes.
Like, isn't that like the value of a movie where it's like, there is a cultural value and an overall kind of like contribution to the craft. But also when I'm going to go see a movie, I'm like, I want to have a good time. And I also feel like nobody is going into XXX being like, I really need this to be a commentary on the world we live in now and make some really, really salient points about our world.
Yeah.
Everyone is going to that movie to go see some people drive some fast cars, deliver some pretty bad dialogue, punch each other a little bit, and then get away with all of it. Uh-huh. And they do that. So it's perfect. What's the problem?
XXX is my parasite. I'll say it right now.
Okay, well, that I'm going to have to take issue with. But
wait until I do my Little White Lies book about the making of XXX with Vin Diesel and the director of Fast and Furious.
Davey Jenkins, call us. Slim needs to talk about his publishing career. Okay, so is that also the same reason that you gave 4.5 stars to the otherwise 2.8 average rated The Poker King starring Jack Black? We mean The Dance.
Yeah. Well, I really like it when Jack Black gets to be in movies, and especially as like main characters in movies that aren't necessarily like comedies. Like, I really loved Bernie, and this sort of falls in that respect where I'm like, yeah, like I just like to see him do his thing. He's a very magnetic performer. He's great.
Slim, do you have an issue with Karen's Predator?
I was just getting ready to bring this up, but you have The Predator. Shane Black, yeah, 4 stars, Karen. Tell me about this.
I did?
4 stars for The Predator.
I don't believe it.
Somebody
maybe
got
that
my
was
password.
A slip of the maybe that was a slip of the finger rating. Maybe that's what we're figuring
wow,
out right now.
I've reviewed this film 4 stars. Wow. Well, I don't know what to say about that because in retrospect, like I was thinking about it recently because obviously Prey came out and everyone was talking about the Predator franchise. I don't remember a thing about this movie, and I don't think I really liked it, which is why I'm so shocked that I gave it 4 stars. So here's a look at the inner workings of my mind.
Karen Han was our guest today. Her book, Bong Joon-ho Dissident Cinema, is out in November. You can pre-order it now to make sure you're a true Bong Hive member. The link is in the notes on this episode. Thanks to our crew, Jack for the facts, Brian Formo for booking and looking after our guests, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, and to Monica for the theme music, and to you, Slim, for editing all of my flubs.
Be sure to listen to our other podcast, Weekend Watchlist. Every Thursday, myself, Mitchell, and Mia explore the latest releases in cinemas and on streaming. It's a very important show. Support your local theaters if you can. And if you feel like dropping us a line, our email address is podcast@letterboxd.com.
I wish someone would. Have we had any letters, Slim?
I have my letter envelope opener right now. We have a letter to read from Robert. He left us an email. Hello, heard you guys saying you wanted people to drop in more emails at the end of the latest episode and thought I'd say how much I love your podcast.
Aww.
I get so excited for new episodes of Weekend Watchlist and for faves. Everyone, and I mean everyone, Slim, Gemma, Mitchell, and Mia are so funny and all have such great chemistry together. I can't help but smile and laugh along. Apart from that, I adore the amount of movies I hear about from both shows. Even when you guys shuffle something on Weekend Watchlist, I sometimes become so intrigued with what you guys end up getting, and I race to add it to my watch list. The show is by far my favorite podcast out there. More importantly, the show has expanded the types of movies I watch, which is such a rare and amazing thing. So thank you for putting so much amazing work and effort into it, because I guarantee that it pays off every single week. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert. You can send that email every week. Just cut and paste. Easy.
Gemma has that letter framed behind her desk right now. Framed email letter.
Yeah.
So wonderful email. And if anyone wants to leave us some other ones, you can do so at podcast@letterboxd.com. Let's see, what else I have to say? The Letterbox Show is a Tape Deck production.
I don't have a line at the end. I feel like I had a line.
The letter has thrown us off.
Yeah.
We're all out of sorts.
Oh God, I've got to go. 2 seconds. Slim, let's have a cold one.
I can fly!
Yes! You can fly!
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.